Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A couple of quick reminders. At 1:30 this afternoon, we will have live coverage of Governor Cuomo's State of the State address on our AM station, AM 820 WNYC. And during it, I'll be hosting a live simultaneous online chat. So let's have a State of the State listening party and viewing party. If you're listening to it on the station or if you're watching it on television, you can go to our politics website at the same time. It's freecountry.org and hang out with other viewers and listeners to the State of the State address and with me. So that's 1:30 on AM 820 WNYC and the simultaneous online chat at itsfreecountry.org. And coming up tomorrow, how many friends does one person need? Psychologist Robin Dunbar explains Dunbar's number, which says in the age of Facebook, as before, about 150. Robin Dunbar explains Dunbar's number and how many friends you need tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. But in today's Village Voice, readers of Wayne Barrett's column get a surprise, his farewell. After 33 years with the weekly paper, he was let go for budgetary reasons, laid off. We think he might qualify as one of the most frequent guests on this program. He's been on the show 40 times since 1994, which was when we started electronic record keeping. May not be as much as our Bob Henley or Andrea Bernstein, I'm not sure, but we don't have to pay Wayne. So for us, this is the end of an era, and he joins us now to talk about the stories he's covered, the state of journalism, and his brand of muckraking in particular, and what's next. Wayne Barrett, welcome back to WNYC.
I'm so glad to be here. It feels like home.
So first, can you tell us just what's going on The Voice and why they decided they can't afford you anymore?
Well, who knows? You know, the funny thing about life, Brian, is the big things that happen to us, no one ever bothers to explain them. I mean, all I can tell you is what they told me, that it was a budget question. I'm sure in the world of alternative weekly newspapers, I'm sure I'm an expensive ticket. And so that's the best I can say as to why they decided to do this. I was surprised by it. I think it's a door opener for me in some ways. And I think these fingers can still hit the keys. I miss the D's sometimes on the keyboard, but other than that, I get most of the keys, and I think I'll be writing a lot of stuff, and I have a place to hang my hat now over at the Nation Institute, and it really frees me to write for a number of different places, and I expect to do that, but I don't really understand what happened there. I just want to say a word about my colleague, Tom Robbins.
Who is also leaving, correct?
Yeah, and, you know, the Times noted this morning that he gave a kidney to one of his friends some years ago, and I sat in the hospital room, you know, after the operation, and the nurse came in and said, do you want to go see your brother? He's in the recovery room, because they just assumed it was a relative. And so I said to him, he's now a guy with one kidney and three balls. he just left this job, and no one knows whether or not you get another one in these circumstances and this economy. And it was just a really wonderful thing he did.
Now, listeners, we're going to spend a lot of this conversation with Wayne Barrett looking back at some of the stories that he has written about for The Voice. We'll talk a little bit about the state of politics in New York, because that's primarily what he does, is write about New York. Today, this final column starts with, Ed Koch and I were inaugurated on the same day in 1978. He became mayor and I became his weekly tormentor. So going back to that, or anything else bringing us to the very head-scratching present in New York State and New York City, call in and talk to Wayne Barrett. Ask him anything you want to ask. Say anything you want to say. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. But before we revisit some of your work, you mentioned your fellow legendary investigative reporter Tom Robbins leaving with you. Is it the end of an era? Is it not just you two at one newspaper? Is there anyone else doing the kind of work that you and Tom do? I might include the late Jack Newfield, Jimmy Breslin, the late Murray Kempton. Do you see other reporters following in your footsteps, or is there an ilk that's now disappearing from New York journalism?
I think there's an outstanding group of young reporters. You know, you have to start with someone like Liz Benjamin, who doesn't do, man, because she's got to turn out 10 pieces a day, so she can't do investigative reporting, but a finer reporter I've never seen.
For the Daily News NYNN?
And, well, yes, now with, yes, and, you know, there's just a David Friedlander, who is now with the New York Observer, a tremendous young reporter who was actually a student of mine at Columbia Journalism and who wrote his paper about Jack Newfield. So there's a lot of young people coming up. This is and some of them may wind up at The Voice, and frankly, I hope some of them wind up at The Voice. I certainly think I gave my life to this institution. I love it, and I hope it prospers after I'm gone. It is an institution where the people who own it now are based in Phoenix, but they have a long tradition of local investigative reporting. They believe in this. They own weekly papers all across the country, so I don't think their decision about me, as much as I regret it, I don't think it means that The Voice itself passes, you know, on as a viable institution in the city that it can affect our culture and our politics. I really think that there's some very smart people there, and that they will make it sing again. And I hope they will. But the problem with the news business is it's so complex that we really don't have a working business model anymore. And if we depend on the number of hits a story gets, if that shapes who we hire, who we retain, if it's all based on some calculation of hits, which we sell advertising on the basis of hits, then a story about Eric Schneiderman is never going to get as many hits as a story about Lindsay Lohan. And that is really going to, you know, shape our journalism. And I fear that. And it's something much, much larger than what happens to the Village Voice. It's something that really affects state and local politics in particular, because there is a lot of interest in national politics, and national political stories do get good hits. But it's really tough to compete with the hits on the celebrity beat or the hits on a national political beat when you're doing local political reporting and local investigative reporting. I don't know if that had anything to do with why I'm gone, but I know it's a complex question that people on all news institutions face.
Village Voice columnist Wayne Barrett, my guest on WNYC on the day of his final Village Voice column after 33 years. Our lines are filling up. A lot of people want to talk to you. 212-433-WNYC. We have one remaining open line. But before we go to some of the callers, let's just go back a little bit. And let me go back to that lead of your piece today. Ed Koch and I were inaugurated on the same day in 1978. He became mayor and I became his weekly tormentor. Remind us, how did you torment Ed Koch and why?
Well, there were two reasons, really. I think they were at the core of the Voice criticism, which I embodied and Jack embodied of Koch. One was that he beat Carmine DiSapio, and he was the machine slayer. He was the anti-Tammany figure who then aligned himself with Meade Esposito, Stanley Friedman, Donnie Manis, and all the bosses of his own generation, and in fact provided the bloodstream for the machine in the city. So it was it was the contradictory life. The Voice was, in the days of the reform movement, which Koch was a leader of, the Voice was the newspaper of the reform movement. So there was a sense of betrayal that we felt, and I think it was reflected in our pages. And then the other thing was that we all know that Koch did some memorable things, and some really, especially in his final term, what he did, which no mayor has been able to run away from since, is get the city in the housing business with its own tax levy funds. We had never really spent capital money on housing construction. He invented that. It's his strongest legacy because I think it transformed the face of the city. But in his early terms, he was a planned shrinkage mayor. He was a mayor who was turning his back on minority communities in many ways, and we were a liberal voice. So I think It's really tough to say this on a day when in the New York Times he is quoted as saying that my reporting was superb, and I thank him for it greatly. But I think our critiques of him were justified in those early days in the administration. I had a dinner with him after he was gone as mayor, and I said to him, I don't regret a word I wrote about you, but I wish I'd written some of the nice things that I should have said. Particularly, I did write, I would do them almost as caveats in a piece rather than a freestanding piece, but I did write how great he was on some of the housing issues in his final term. And I should have given them freestanding stories rather than just a paragraph hidden in a story of criticism.
That's really interesting. So do you think that we've come full circle in a way, because Koch came in as the mayor who was going to help New York dig out of the fiscal crisis of the 1970s. Now here we are in the fiscal crisis of the 2010s. And again, there's this debate over cutting health care and education for the poor rather than doing that while raising taxes for the, you know, for the very wealthy to stave it off a little bit. And have we kind of come full circle?
Well, we're back on the same page. I think that's really fair. You're talking now much more at a state level than at a city level.
Correct.
The budget that faces Andrew Cuomo, and, you know, Koch did a masterful job in his early administration. You may remember that he closed the gap earlier than he had to in terms of the federal loans that the city had received. And so he was masterful in a fiscal sense in the first term of it. But he also turned a cold shoulder to folks. And, hopefully Andrew Cuomo is not going to repeat that pattern of, in a very tough budget situation, not being conscious of reaching out to the people who are most hurt by the budget decisions that are being made. I was very dismayed to read in the last couple of days that Andrew Cuomo is against extending the income tax surcharge on the wealthiest. I think that's a deplorable position. He did promise no new taxes, but he didn't tell us when he ran for governor that he wasn't going to extend an old one. And we are now going to go back, unless he extends this tax surcharge, we are going to go back with a state income tax where everybody who earns more than $40,000 is in the same tax bracket. That is not a democratic, progressive tax system. And his play to the post, his play to the business council, to me, the Committee to Save New York and the folks who want to say it's time for pension change and all the other changes that are necessary, that I believe are necessary, these folks, if they had any political smarts, would say we're in favor of extending the surcharge. And then, since we still have a giant gap after they extended the surcharge, then they would be free to say, now labor has to give us something. Instead, it's all or nothing.
So let's go back again. In your column yesterday, you wrote, the greatest prize I ever won for the work I've done in these pages was when Al D'Amato called me a viper in his memoir. What was that about?
Well, I'd been on his tail forever. And, you know, I like to think, and I really believe this is true, that that though I'm a liberal Democrat, when I am covering and investigating misconduct, that it has no partisan flavor whatsoever. And so I wrote many, many stories about Alphonse D'Amato. And I think his reference to me as a viper in his book was just an accumulation of that. And then, as I noted in The Voice, when Chuck Schumer defeated him in 98, then years later he wrote his own book, and he attributed it to a story I had written about D'Amato, which was on the eve of the election. And I think, you know, it's rare that one story has such a big impact. And I don't pat myself on the shoulders or on the back about many of the stories, but that one little story that I did, it was only a few hundred words, but it had an enormous impact. And you may remember, Brian, that the big issue that Al D'Amato used against Chuck Schumer was that Chuck Schumer was missing votes in the Congress when he ran for Senate. So I was able to show that when D'Amato ran for the Senate, he was the presiding supervisor of Hempstead, and then he missed more than 1,000 votes. And it kind of blew a hole in the hypocrisy of the D'Amato campaign, and it was very gratifying that it had that kind of an impact.
And made you a viper. But as you point out, Your reporting has shown up in negative campaign ads for both Republicans and Democrats over the years, even a Palladino ad against Andrew Cuomo.
Yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, the funny thing was that the day the Schumer ad went up about my story in the 98 campaign, D'Amato answered with an ad that was also drawn from my copy about Chuck Schumer. And the story that I wrote about Chuck Schumer in the early 1980s led to the impaneling of a grand jury and the investigation of Schumer on charges. He never was indicted, but he came very close to being indicted. And so in that instance, I was sitting there watching commercials on television, and it was a duel between one of my clips and another one of my clips.
Pretty good. And you had reported years ago on how Andrew Cuomo, when he was HUD secretary, Housing and Urban Development Secretary in the Clinton administration, basically helped launch the unsustainable lending policies under Fannie and Freddie that contributed to coming back to bite us. And that's what Palladino was using against Andrew Cuomo. Now, we're going to take a break. We will continue with Wayne Barrett. We will go to your calls for the rest of the segment. Anything you want to say or ask of Wayne Barrett on the day of his final Village Voice columns publication after 33 years writing for the legendary Alternative Weekly. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 to reminisce or talk present or even future New York politics with Wayne Barrett. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking to Village Voice columnist Wayne Barrett. You may have been surprised to pick up the brand new edition of The Voice today and see that Wayne Barrett is leaving the paper. He was basically laid off for budgetary reasons after 33 years. Russ in Inwood. You're on WNYC. Hello, Russ.
Hello, Brian. First, I think Wayne deserves the Mike Berger Prize for Outstanding New York Journalism. It's given out by the Columbia School of Journalism. I intend to see that he gets a nomination. But what really concerns me is what Wayne said about blogging. He said that he will only blog when he's got something to say. But most blogs are a clever regurgitation of somebody else's news. Now, unfortunately, that's what's happened at The Voice with Running Scared. It's a lot of young people trying hard, but basically spitting back what they got somewhere else. And I wondered if Wayne would want to elaborate on that.
And Running Scared, for people who don't know, is the name of the column that Wayne has written. Now other people write. Wayne, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's certainly not just The Voice that does this. The Voice is really part of a pattern of this, that, you know, there's an awful lot of blogs, unlike Liz Benjamin's blog, for example, or Celeste Katz's blog at the Daily News, which are really blogs where reporters report something new on the hour. Now, how young people do that is pretty freaking amazing to me. But what we have, and many, many other places have it, is people who read the news, who write extremely well, have extraordinarily punchy style in what they present, and they basically recycle other people's reporting. I think it's a phase. I really cannot imagine. It's always been my belief that people come to you as a writer and a reporter because you've uncovered some news for them to read. And if it's just that you've recycled somebody else's news, for a while, maybe that works and it attracts hits. But in the long term, I've never believed that that will work. So when they asked me to start blogging at The Voice, I really started loving doing it, because if you've been a weekly reporter forever, you don't have the immediacy of writing something. And I would write it three times a week whenever I wasn't doing a cover, sometimes four times a week. I certainly couldn't keep up with a Benjamin doing it by the hour. But it would be deeply reported stuff. Now, I did blogs that were 3,000 words long, Maybe that's not good. Maybe that's too much information.
But that was your standard, even recently in the, you know, in the era of the blog, as you've been describing, that you had to have something new, not just to say with respect to your observations, but to report.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the opinion, and I write for a liberal democratic newspaper, but the opinion is a consequence of the reporting, you know, and so if you go out and report, yes, I would have opinion in the piece, and I'm not a blank slate. I've been on the beat for 33 years, so I have points of view on issues and on the characters on the beat, but I would let that reporting guide each blog. And there were almost no blogs that I did that didn't have some original reporting in it. And frankly, I think that's what's going to happen. Not that I'm some pioneer on the Internet, but frankly, I believe that that will ultimately be what everybody does, because you can't just recycle other people's work and keep readers coming to you, no matter how snappy the writing is.
Chris in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC with Wayne Barrett. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going, Brian?
Good.
Good, yes. Wayne, this is Chris from 2001, one of Wayne's interns, one of the many he had over the years. And I want to just point out that Wayne has single-handedly created a media conspiracy to take over all the journalist posts in New York and the East Coast. So many interns have gone through his halls, learning, getting their butts kicked, learning how to not be just punk writers, but actually reporters and people who cared about digging up the facts. So I just want to say thank you, Wayne, on behalf of all of us. You've made us what we are today.
Oh, gee, that's so sweet, and I really appreciate it. You know, I put something in that farewell about the interns because I said in the piece that the interns have helped me think young, and I think that's so true. I got a lot of emails from interns in the last couple of days, and I wrote one back saying, I really honestly believe this, that I learned as much from them as they did from me. And it's been a great experience. You know, I teach a little bit now up at Columbia Journalism, and I there's just nothing I get more joy out of than working with young journalists, and I am very, very thankful for the Barrett Army.
Nick in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Wayne Barrett. Hello, Nick.
Yes, I'm a journalist as well and went to Columbia, and I wanted to tell you that I very much appreciated the series that you wrote on George Pataki and his shenanigans up in Peekskill, New York.
Oh.
And I thought as we followed some of the paths that you laid out for what he was up to, it got more and more complex. I think that probably he got away with a tremendous amount as governor. I also would ask if you see two parts of this. Do you see more investigation of him, but do you see support for investigative reporting coming now more from private philanthropy? How do people get paid, and how will they get paid for the kind of work you've been doing? And I'll get off the phone now.
Thank you for your call, Nick.
Well, first on Pataki, I had to go in the voice and clean out my about 40 or 50 file drawers the other day, and you know, trying not to take too much paper with me. So I faced the question of, is George Pataki a real Republican candidate for president? And should I bring my hundreds of file folders about George Pataki with me?
And what did you decide?
I dumped them.
He can't compete with Sarah Palin.
I kept a couple.
Haley Barbour.
I kept a couple, but I just don't think it's real. So,
what was that story that the caller was referring to?
Well, I did a series. I tell you, I actually got pneumonia or bronchitis or something doing that series. I was out in Westchester every day for months there during that campaign. There's nothing like a new character on the beat running for the top job in the state.
So that was 1994.
Yeah, so I was out there forever, and I must have written six or seven stories. Almost all of them got cover treatment. I you know, and the Times did do a follow on my thing, that my stories that I think took up a page and a half in the paper. And so it wasn't like they were all dead letters. They had some impact, but you know, it was he was just such an inviting subject. And all of my stories were really about his prior history as mayor of Peekskill and what he did with his own personal real estate development and so forth out in, you know, and we all know who won the election. So I found him to be a fascinating character, and I certainly continued to cover him. And Andrew Cuomo, as Attorney General, did a report on the state police that was in large measure caused by a story I did on Dan Weiss, who was started out when Pataki took office as the head of his detail, the state police detail, but just rose to great power in the state police and took the Fifth Amendment. So I kept on the Pataki trail, and I certainly agree with the caller that George Pataki, you know, the Times did a cover story in their magazine once, very early, calling him bland ambition. And that's what it was. He's that this amiable, bland guy, and he never got the investigative attention that I think he deserved. I think he just ran a government that was an invitation to hard investigative reporting. I tried
and
to keep up.
Didn't happen very much other than you. And it's true about Pataki and bland ambition. And it's one of the reasons that he got elected in the first place. New York was tired of the Mario Cuomo eloquence, but with disappointing results to many over a 12-year period, and they wanted some bland ambition at that time. I think that the telling of the Wayne Barrett archive would not be complete without mentioning your change of heart about Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
He was the hero of your book, City for Sale, which came out in the late 80s when he was a prosecutor, but then more the GOAT in your next couple of books after he became mayor.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, Brian, if you remember that documentary Hoop Dreams, where they just really literally stuck a camera in the face of these young black kids, I think, in Chicago, who were playing basketball. And over a period of 5 years or 6 years, the same camera on the same kids, and you saw the metamorphosis of these kids. I always have believed that with Rudy, if you ever had that kind of a Hoop Dream documentary, that you would see the utter transformation of a public figure. I admired him greatly as a federal prosecutor. I know he made some mistakes then, but I think his record still stands by and large. You know, what United States attorney would go after the Attorney General of the United States, which he did? He went after Ed Meese, who was the president's best friend. So he did it in a nonpartisan fashion. He broke the machine in New York. He did so many great things as a federal prosecutor, and I believed he was a man of great integrity. And I knew him extremely well as when he was a federal prosecutor. And to see what he became over a course of his lifetime was just, it was just terrible
without,
to behold.
Without relitigating what you or others liked or didn't like about Giuliani, I think we know his record and, you know, what people like or don't like. What changed? Did something change? Did he have a change of heart? Or was that the inner Rudy in the context of urban affairs that just didn't have a chance to be expressed when he was a prosecutor and doing different work?
Well, you know, I in the first book that I did on Rudy, I kind of, you know, bared my soul a little. I thought I confessed to the fact that I ignored some of his weaknesses. For example, when he was in the Justice Department, he was terrible on the question of Haitian refugees in Florida, just behaved awful in an awful way. And I had some sort of an awareness of that, but I never explored it as fully as I should have at the time. So part of it was a little bit of undeserved romance on my part. But I think that there's no question but that once he entered the political arena, the ambition and drive that got him to do the things that he did to the Haitians in Florida took over the other part of his public personality, and he just was completely unequipped to bring to the political game the integrity that he brought, in, by and large, to his Justice Department service. He was unequipped to do it, and every hand he could shake was another opportunity to make a deal.
Let me slip in one more caller, Gregory in Park Slope. You're on WNYC. Greg, we got 30 seconds for you.
Hey, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
Really happy to talk to both of you. But Mr. Barrett, I want to say that you inspired me as a young college student to start a newspaper called Latino Journal Upstate to report on Latino state politics. And we did it from 1987 to 1994, and we were able to get a paper done that showed that the first Governor Cuomo wasn't hiring enough Latinos in the bureaucracy, and it really aggravated him.
Yeah.
And then we did the same paper this past about two weeks ago, and the new Andrew Cuomo didn't like it either.
Yeah.
So it was just you've inspired us to do things.
Well, I think that picture in the Times of the cabinet, I don't think there was a single Latino at the table, was there?
Huh, in the new Cuomo cabinet,
yeah.
Which is still being appointed,
yeah.
But interesting and important observation. We just have 30 seconds left, and I don't want to make this like a eulogy like you're dying. You're only 65, and you're going off to your next gig, as you said, at the Nation Institute. So are we going to see you in the on the national pages of the Nation magazine next?
Well,
we have 20
seconds. The Nation Institute is very meticulous about, since it's a nonprofit and it's concerned about the IRS, of making sure that it places stories in a diverse number of magazines around the country, one of them being The Nation.
Wayne Barrett, his final column for The Village Voice, is in today's edition after 33 years with the Greenwich Village Weekly. I don't think this is the last time we're going to talk to each other.
Oh, terrific, Brian.
Let's keep going.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Right,
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Talk to you tomorrow. Don't forget, at 1:30 today, live coverage of Andrew Cuomo's State of the State on AM 820 WNYC, and we'll be hosting a live chat on itsafreecountry.org.